Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
This episode of All the President's Minutes is brought to you by bellacatering.com.au. Bella Catering, one of Sydney's very best catering companies, run by Glenn and Maria and their team. Glenn is a degenerate, but their entire team is absolutely incredible. Great food, great reasonable prices, great delivery all around Greater Sydney. So do yourselves a favor, don't cook. Order some food from bellacatering.com.au. They are going to be a company that has the staying power to survive past COVID-19, but with your help. So if you can, bellacatering.com.au, you can check them out. They are definitely friends of the show and of this series and of all One Heat Minute Productions. And we're very proud that they jumped on as a sponsor to All the President's Minutes. We're happy to point people in their direction. We love them dearly. So if you guys have got a few extra bucks and you don't want to cook, really, who the hell wants to cook right now? I mean, you're just looking at that number in Victoria of coronavirus patients go up and up, thinking about things shutting down. Order some catering. Cater for the remaining family. You can get to your house in Sydney right now. Thank you so much for listening. Here's the show.
Now more than ever, Australia cannot afford to be unreconciled. We must accept that this nation is in transition, confronted by the necessity of the voice to Parliament, constitutional recognition, truth-telling and agreement-making. We must avoid going down the path of seeing history as a set of competitive narratives and instead work towards the pursuit of truth and respect. We need a political settlement on questions of national independence, integrity and identity. 250 years of avoiding these fundamental questions has handicapped us as a nation from navigating the complex challenges before us and left us unable to capitalise on the great opportunities of a future together. We feel this confusion in our public discourse, with well-meaning policy objectives failing to meet the expectations of modern multicultural Australia. Standards we recognise when crossed but seem unwilling to speak about honestly. We've seen generations of political leaders come and go, blindly clutching for a sense of common ground, common identity, without addressing the darkness of dispossession and racism, keeping us chained to the ethnocentric understanding of Australia's identity, one that has never really been true. We have a system unable to understand or celebrate diversity and difference, and First Nations are left to deal with a bureaucratic machine that has often been a tool more of oppression than of liberation. The path forward has been offered to us through the Uluru Statement from the Heart. The Parliament must honour that call and listen to the torment of the powerlessness that continues to haunt this place. Only then will we continue on the path of reconciliation, built on honour, equality, recognition and respect, and free from racism.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. In Australia, we're really lucky for one particular reason, and that is that we've got national broadcasters and specialist broadcasters. ABC, Australian Broadcast Corporation, and SBS, the Special Broadcast Service, to sort of help our minorities have a voice in this country as a broadcast medium. And so it's like to have emerging voices, particularly Indigenous voices, and the weird multicultural, population of Australia, because really 40% of people who live in this country, their parents are from another place. And so that's either by many migrations that have happened since post-World War II. And one of the outlets that has bloomed out of SBS is an outlet called NITV, which is essentially an all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander service that has really great news reporters, great content, great football content actually recently. Even if you're a nice welcome respite, if you're ever a person who's ever watched a footy show in your life, actually watching Yoka footy and things like that. But what's been really interesting is that in our country, while a lot of the sort of hegemonic media has been echoing these same sentiments of like nonsense and lies and denial, NITV has been a great service to sort of culturally contextualize Indigenous Australian voices in the entire movement of Black Lives Matter as it is emerging in 2020 again. And so it's kind of my pleasure to talk to any of the producers and the folk that work along with that network. And I'm really pleased today to talk to a digital editor at NITV and the co-host of a podcast, which I love so much, the title, Take It Black, B-L-A-K. I might have to take it, Blake, off of you. I think if I ever have another podcast in the future, if it's just a, I might call it Take It Blake, because I think I like that. He's a digital editor at NITV News. He's a podcaster. He's a writer, and I'm really thankful to chat to him today. Jack Lattimore, mate, thank you so much for being a part of the show.
No problem at all, Blake. I'm glad to be here, and I'm flattered that you love the title, Take It Black. I was just saying to you that I really like the concept around this podcast. I wish I'd come up with it myself as well, and I think it's just got so much potential for doing a whole bunch of things. So, yeah, I'm glad to be here and be part of this episode.
Yeah, man. Look, I folks who have been listening along to the One Heat Minute Productions feed, they know we're, you know, we did our One Heat Minute show, and a lot of folk were thinking at the time, you know, and would ask me often, if you're new to the show and you're listening, welcome. They would say like, oh, you're going to do another Michael Mann movie? You're going to do something? And we did our little victory lap show I call Last 12 Minutes of the Mohicans, which is just a little celebration with some of our great guests from that show. But I was really keen on another long form show. And if I was going to do one, I wanted something that had the possibility for like a whole bunch of different dialogue, you know, because and at the time, and I sort of talked to this as we were just chatting, warming up for the show, but I was like, wouldn't it be great to do in an election year to talk about all the president's minutes, you know, to talk about all the president's men a minute at a time, because there's just so much there. You could talk to journos, you could talk to historians, you know, you could talk to film folk, you could talk to, you know, disgraced politicians. Our country's got a few of those. We could probably get on the show maybe. And if you're a disgraced politician, you're listening now, please reach out. My DMs are open. But I thought, oh, this would be interesting. And I could not have, there's no way you could ever have a crystal ball to look at the way that the world has shifted in 2020. And so what I felt now is that the show is even more urgent to talk about, because it is literally the grind of people speaking truth to power. And in the last year, you know, some of the most dynamic truth to power is people standing in front of police, holding up their phone and recording what's happening. And that is some of the most dynamic filmmaking. Might be some of the most dynamic truth telling and journalism. And I think a lot of those, a lot of concepts about a lot of institutions and structures that we thought were these monoliths that could never collapse, it would always be the same. This whole year has just been about like what is next? What is the next domino in this thing that can fall, and what can drastically change? And I think right now, even though some of the mechanisms of some really great journalism papers and things like that aren't solvent and aren't making their money because they're so relying on ad revenue, I don't think that that's stopping unbelievable writing and reporting across a whole bunch of different channels, whether that's podcasts, whether that's stuff that you guys do at NITV, whether that's, you know, the other big publications that are surviving on a subscriber basis. It's a pretty incredible time.
Oh yeah. It's phenomenal. And like, can we take any more this year? Firstly,
no.
We're up to like is it the third apocalypse? Is that where we're at?
I can't remember on my horseman of the apocalypse clock which horseman we're up to. It has to be three. It's got to be three. The wolf from the fourth is coming, I think.
In Melbourne, where I'm based, we're up to the second zombie apocalypse. So second lockdown. We're seeing the same sorts of, waves of people going through the toilet paper aisles of the supermarkets, you know, buying their millet, their rice. you know, putting it in the bunker or the attic, probably buying dogs. There was a rush on pets, particularly dogs, at one point. There's some strange shit going on. And yeah, I mean, in terms of the acceleration of news media, even just in the past 6 months, it feels like things have changed. I mean, we're talking today across Zoom.
Yes.
That wasn't something not so long ago.
Didn't exist.
And now, you know, NITV Newsroom's got this Zoom, not this one, but we've got a Zoom account.
Yes.
And reliant on that Zoom account for a lot of content that we would use for, you know, television.
Yes.
You know, the cameramen would be hating it and quite anxious, but, you know, sending out a team and get those high quality images and the, you know, the on location with the lighting and all of that sort of stuff, that's gone out the window.
Yeah.
Through necessity. And now we're using, you know, what the quality of what we're looking at each other now. You know? I did an interview via Skype in January before the COVID really, you know, spiked up.
Yeah.
And that used Skype, an interview with a fellow named Terry Yumble, who was located up in East Arnhem Land on country. And we used that footage for the television, for the news bulletin, and elsewhere for television, as well as for online. And, yep, you know, that wouldn't have been done not so long ago. The quality alone would have been dismissed. But what it did enable was for us to tell that an important story that added a little bit of a corrective to something that Andrew Bolt had published. So it kind of...
You could build a whole career doing correctives on what Andrew Bolt says. I mean...
Well, with this one, he left himself a little bit open.
Actually, Jack, can you contextualize for international listeners? Because I haven't actually spoken too much about Mr. Bolt. Could you contextualize that for folk who aren't aware of who he is? Because I think, you know, there are definitely equivalencies in probably the Fox News media for American listeners out there. But
I think that's probably the easiest way to and most efficient way to put it is that he's Australia's Bob Riley or
yes,
you know, whoever else they've got there at the moment. In Australia, for foreign international listeners, in Australia, we've always had that element, I suppose.
Like, yeah,
we've always had an Alan Jones or, you know, someone of that ilk.
Yeah.
The other fella up there in Sydney, 2GB, Ray Hadley.
Yeah.
We've always had him, Neil Mitchell down where I'm at, Southern State, Victoria. John Laws, I suppose, is another one. We've yeah, always had a fascination and an appetite, broadly speaking, as listeners and viewers, for that sort of right to hard right to ultra-conservative perspective on the world and as a purveyor of news. And I guess our export in Rupert Murdoch got on to that. Like, a lot of people don't know that early on Rupert Murdoch was seen as a bit of a lefty and as a bit of a progressive in terms of his approach to doing things. He got out of the shadow of his old man a little bit. And I think over in Adelaide, he was put in charge of the Advertiser. If it wasn't that newspaper, it was one similarly, you know, inclined at that point, and he was very progressive around a case involving a young Aboriginal fellow, and there was a lot of favourable reporting towards this young bloke and this young fella, and it was Rupert behind it, and it was seen as quite progressive reporting for that period in Australia. Something happened. He went out in the desert or something happened, and he became really, you know, what we know Murdoch to be today and went internationally. I think he got his eye in the UK and then, you know, went across to the US and established Fox and Fox News in particular. So we were the prototype I guess, of the Fox News phenomenon here in Australia, and that legacy persists. We now have Sky News After Dark, which is a really strange...
The last After Dark show that I watched was Big Brother After Dark. And let's be fair, we were all watching it for the TNA or for some clothed bodies, attractive people doing stupid things on national television. I just feel like it's even all the more affronting that Sky News has an After Dark and then just pre-populates it with all of these racist people.
Look, it's, like, it's the same dynamic as Big Brother After Dark, really. If you look at it through a particular lens or in a certain light, there's the same stuff going on there. Anyway, this Bolt character, he's got his own show on Sky News After Dark, and he's had a show elsewhere, and he's got a column, and he's I think one of his little sort of spruiking lines is he's Australia's most popular columnist or something along that sort of line.
Folks, actually, I have seen. Yep. He was in both, you know, I call one, they're the two sides of the Apocalypse Now coin. I call them Apocalypse Now and then Hearts of Darkness, a filmmaker's Apocalypse, are both better together. The documentary behind Apocalypse Now and then Apocalypse Now, the film. And I think that the final quarter, the Adam Goods doco, and then the Australian Dream, Stan Grant's accompanying doco, are like the Apocalypse Now and Hearts of Darkness. Together they are better because the final quarter is sort of a pure hindsight commentary, and then Stan Grant's is like into the motivation and mindset. And Andrew Bolt, if folks maybe internationally have seen one or both of those movies, and if you haven't, do everything you can to seek him out. Absolutely incredible pieces of filmmaking. And he does feature in both of those as a political commentator. So maybe that's where some people might have seen him before. Just think of the guy saying the most heinous things, drumming up the most, the sort of mean and twisted and continually twisted and bent perspectives on the factual things. Is kind of his
The point that still in Australia you have notable people who put forward the proposition that Andrew might be putting it on a little bit.
Yes.
You know, they still go, surely he can't be that racist. Surely he can't be that much of an unethical monster. Those sorts of things are set out there, not by me, obviously, but you know, they're out there in the sphere, and there is contention around whether he's legit in a lot of these views that he holds, or whether he's gaming it, like, you know, we have seen shock jocks do around the world from time to time.
Yeah.
But interestingly, Bolt himself kind of parallels the trajectory of Rupert Murdoch in some ways. I think early on, maybe before he was writing, but a bit like that PJ O'Rourke over there, he was seen as a bit of a lefty.
Yes.
He had his Jack Kerouac moment where he went hitching around Australia, and at some point he's decided or positioned himself, in the conservative corner, and that's he found some success in doing that, and increasingly, I would submit, increasingly went in that direction as the success grew.
Yeah, it's funny. In both instances, we've just talked about Rupert Murdoch and Andrew Bolt. What is the Australian outback when these guys see, you know, Indigenous history talks about, or Indigenous culture talks about, a walkabout as a moment of manhood and enlightenment? What backward shit happened to these guys? Man, they must have been broken in their souls and their brains to go out for these moments of enlightenment and then coming back and going, I understand how to manipulate this. I understand how to game this system, and I don't have to be moral about it, because the morality is not as important as money. And that feels like both of those guys. Bolt, I don't contend that same. I think he's he's a bit of an egomaniac, which is why people probably think of the consistency of his act is, you know, that it's just an act and behind closed doors, he might be different. But Murdoch is an interesting one. It is pure. It feels like money is the only thing that runs through that man's veins, you know, so that concept of money. So it's very
winning.
And winning. Yeah.
Like he will jump behind, you know, in Australia, two major party sort of political system, and he will swap horses midstream, whatever, as long as he is, you know, behind the inevitable winner. Sometimes, yep. You know, perhaps Kraft through his newspaper and his media empire, he owns about, I don't know what it's up to, but it's above 80% concentration of Australia's media. It'd probably be 85% now. I'm not too certain of where we're at.
Since the Herald / is that Age in Melbourne? Have I got that right? I got that right.
The Herald Sun. No, yeah. The Age went to Nine Entertainment.
Oh, Nine. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry. Herald Sun was there. Yeah. So he's about 85 when you count the television as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that particular program, Sky News After Dark, ended up being taken on by regional broadcasters, WIN, I think. So around regional Australia, outside of the metropolitan areas, if you're that way inclined, you're able to tune in and watch Sky News After Dark on your free-to-air television as well. You can probably add that it is a part of Australia's cable or, you know, paid.
Yeah.
But it's leaked out into free-to-air. And recently he offloaded a bunch of regional papers, or they folded. In terms of direction and where those people in those regional areas or zones would now access their points of news is up in the air a little bit. They may go to the internet. We don't have great internet coverage in the bush, particularly not everywhere in the bush. A regional hub may have pretty good coverage, but then, say, 2 or 3 kilometres outside of that regional hub, there is no signal whatsoever. So I guess they're then funneled towards purchasing newspapers from the local newsagent, the hard copy of which we have two, Rupert's newspapers, the big metro ones, which are pretty rabid and in the same vein, as I would argue, in the same vein as the Sky News After Dark sort of stuff, or Nine Entertainment, which was formerly owned by a company or corporation named Fairfax, and they folded. And were bought out by Nine Entertainment. Now, we've seen a trend towards conservative end of the spectrum with both of their main mastheads in the newspaper world, which is The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. So there's not a, you know, off the shelf, there's not a lot of option there for Australians. And we do have the Saturday paper, which would be seen as being, you know, a far left rag or something like that, which is provided, I guess it's a bit of a folly for a fellow that I would sort of position him as a bit of a centrist, a political centrist. But yeah, that's viewed as some sort of lefty, extreme lefty type thing in Australia. So there's not a lot of option. That would not be stocked at most regional newspapers or news agencies.
No. And I think the word that I love the most there is when you said it is leaked from cable. it feels like a leak. It feels like a stain because, yeah, like the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age were definitely more in opposition and in opposition to the Murdoch papers in those towns. What is heartening, though, and there seems to be a few more of them popping up, is that there are big enough local bush communities or just rural communities in general who are starting up like these really threadbare operations, like 3 or 4 journos just on the ground in the town and doing like a weekly news roundup for the local areas and are getting subscriptions and things like that and local advertisers in to actually just keep themselves solvent on their scale. So looking at a local town paper. So we're seeing a few more of those pop up and being independent, which is unreal. It's happening, you know, all around the world, but it's happening, I think, now five or six by my account that I've been following along in Oz. And actually, Keen, if anyone's actually listening, you know, off the back of listening to Jack and I talk today or any other podcast, please reach out because I'd love to talk to you about, you know, literally doing the fastidious on the ground local journalism city beat in your own town during this crazy crisis. I'd love to talk to you. But I think that that's, you know, you speak a challenge. People talk about like the complete dilution or diffusion of media in different countries. And in the US, you know, it's either, I think it's the MSNBC/CNN side or Fox News. It kind of feels like the left and the right. But in Oz, yeah, it's definitely very, very similar. And now also, like you said, it's moving even away from the left and just plonking itself on the center. It's like our very central circular thing happening. All around.
There's another dangerous thing that's happening here, and that is because of that scenario, we have a heavy reliance on social media to provide news.
Yes.
And as everyone around the world would know, the problems with that, you know, particularly with Facebook. But I guess Facebook's still massive here, massive. As it was back in 2012 to 2014, I think it peaked. It definitely did for me. And then I migrated across to Twitter. And now we see in Australia, at least, Twitter going the same way that Facebook was back then, which was really tribal and toxic. And there's a lot of misinformation on there, but there's a lot of distortion as well. And just the general fosters a sentiment of tribalism, but people, uncritical thinking, you know, people, and, you know, left and right and center, like right across the whole smorgasbord, but people will just take stuff on and pieces of information get distorted really quickly and high risk of becoming something that it's not in terms of interpretation and perspective. And there's a lot of credence given to the weight of things that occur on social media, particularly Twitter. And you see that play, like re-enter the social sphere or the public sphere and have an effect there as well, which again is something new, some sort of technological affordance that has been, you know, in that really rapid acceleration over the last 5 years and particularly in the last couple of years. So yeah, weird times and slippery slopes.
Weird times and slippery slopes indeed. Well, look, let's dive into this minute, which is if we're talking about slippery slopes, we're talking about a bit of a Macca's regroup, which I think is a fun concept to think about, being on the road, just grinding and being like, I'm going to eat crappy Macca's because there's nothing else for me to do. They look like hell. These guys have been on the road, knocking on doors, trying to appeal across moral lines to people to speak out about a crooked president. And so I think having a Macca's meal is probably the only, around so many people, is probably the only thing that feels aged about what we're about to talk about, Jack. So I think let's dive into Alan J. Pakula and Robert Redford's 1976 masterpiece, All the President's Men. This is minute 71. And my guest, Jack Lattimore, and I are going to listen along to it now. You guys are going to listen along too, and then we're going to come back and talk about it.
Carolyn Abbott.
We're just doing something wrong. Never been there.
No.
We're doing something wrong. It's just not good enough.
How can you keep going if something past the point when you believe it?
You just have to start all over again.
Naismith. Narrow, Ness, Nichols, Nixon.
Ed Nixon.
Jolson.
Jones.
Jordan.
Jost.
If we could only get somebody that worked for finance to talk, I can't believe it.
What about the bookkeeper?
Which bookkeeper?
The bookkeeper that worked for both Slans and...
Oh, you're all right.
Sloan and Stans.
I've been there. I called her twice. There's no answer.
I see we should start again.
How do you keep going past the point that you don't believe it? Start all over again. What if that is not the ethos of this entire film? It's so... sometimes by happy accident, a conversation that we're having to preamble a minute, I just think matches so perfectly with the ethos of the minute, which is how do you keep going? You just start again and you keep going. You keep going because it's there. It's that compelling.
And applicable to everything across the board.
Yes. Yeah.
In terms of news, that minute, and I'll just add that the movie itself I hadn't seen since probably 2011, 2012.
Yeah.
It is one of those that, you know, back then I would come home and put on, you know, after a few beers and fall asleep on the couch and, you know, wake up and it'd be finished or whatever. So I've kind of seen it in various, you know, several states of mind, let's say. It was good to go back to watch the minute first that you designated, and then in a really unenviable sobriety.
Yeah.
That lockdown has provided me to watch the entire film. And there's just little elements. I watched it with headphones on an iPad. So it was high fidelity in terms of sound, picking up things that I wouldn't have picked up in certain states of mind from across the lounge room. So it was like watching it for the first time, really. And I've just finished reading Seymour Hersh's biography or autobiography, memoirs, about a month ago. So, you know, in terms of the actual political context, I got a lot more out of it. So, firstly, thank you for making me do that.
That's my pleasure. My pleasure. Both completely understand and empathize that it is a perfect, comforting, warm blanket of a movie that when nothing else seems like you want to go to sleep to or nothing else you want in your mind, you can find great comfort in this movie, which I understand on a deep level. But also that is my being able to welcome more people into the state of like watching every frame of this masterpiece with a heightened level of awareness is so enriching for me. And so whenever I get to hear and talk to folk who actually have the same experience, it's so awesome. I feel like that.
Well, if it got me.
If I own
Conversational dialogue in it. Like that, how do they do that back then? Like was it a lot of the improv or was it, you know, was it scripted that way? I've never read the script. I wouldn't know. But
William Goldman is the Academy Award-winning screenwriter who is behind incredible movies like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and The Princess Bride, and is probably actually more famously sort of known as like I think Bill Simmons, the American sporting journalist, calls him the dean of screenwriters. I think that's how he described him, as like you look at some of the people who he took under his wing and mentored, they're like Aaron Sorkin, David Fincher. Mm-hmm. There are these people who he's had these phenomenal impacts on who are now making their own waves many, many years later. And you know what's so funny is he read the book, obviously, All the President's Men, that the story is based off of, and spent a lot of time in the newsroom himself writing how these guys talked on just how people talked in the newsroom at the time. And one of his early drafts of the script, which he said the entire process was torture, by the way, retroactively. But he said they took jokes out because people were funny, like people were just in the newsroom and just shooting the shit and sounded really natural. And they kept taking elements of humor away and kept that conversational nature and kept it happening and allowed the style of, you know, allowed Redford style and Hoffman style to influence and imprint on the script and the dialogue and keep tweaking it and adding things and pulling it back. And yeah, it's one of those weird films that I say in complete stark contrast to the film I did in depth previously, Heat, which I think is a Michael Mann film so innately and in depth in a way that is just unfathomable to most people. This is a movie of alchemy. Like the script is there. Woodward and Bernstein's story is there. All these great actors give something. just gives something. And the direction by Alan J. Pakula and the cinematographer Gordon Willis, just everything, all these people having their inputs, it all just clashes, and the mix of all these flavors together is magic. And I agree with you. Just the shooting the shit, smiling at someone, saying a joke. Is there any way you don't smoke? Just everything about this movie.
Walking over each other.
Yeah.
Like, and it worked.
Yes.
It provided so much in the scenes, you know, where they're at the door of the source who was part of the committee.
Yes.
And they're trying to convince her, to go on the record and speak to them. And they're talking over one another and trying to work her. And you've got Dustin Hoffman's character, you know, really working. You can probably hear some building going out the back of my house. Really working, you know, the angle, he's full of the gut feeling and all of this sort of thing. And the more methodical Robert Redford character, ethically upright. And it was just, the dynamic between the two was fantastic.
A little hint that I say to you just before we jump onto the ending is one thing I learned about this, and I like to bring it up when we talk about just the way that they can talk over each other, is both these guys, when there's sort of a, I had a film critic friend of mine on the show, and he said, tip of the Dahlberg is a phrase he used, which is when the Dahlberg conversation, he says the tip of the iceberg of the movie, because everything after that, these guys are together. And they both learned each other's lines for the rest of the movie so that they could actually interrupt each other. And I just think it's a dedicated thing for two guys to do for the effect that you're talking about, which is that I know what line you're going to say anyway. And it's you would imagine that they're just making something happen. You watch it happen in sport. You watch it happen with great people you work with. It's like, you know what they're going to say, and you go, I know you're going to say this. I know you're going to say this. So I'm just going to say it ahead of you. And you sort of jump over each other rather. And I think that's just such a great technique that I just don't see enough of it in contemporary movies. Like,
well, it's interesting you mentioned Sorkin. Now, he is the guy behind Newsroom, right?
Newsroom, West Wing.
There was a lot of that in Newsroom. I'm not as familiar with West Wing.
Yeah. Newsroom, he loves it. He loves Sorkin is like fast-paced, like extremely quick, talking over each other. And David Fincher is Zodiac as well. And they both collaborated together on The Social Network. So those sort of things of teams of people shooting the shit, talking over each other, interrupting each other, that alchemy of how they work. Yeah, it's really great. But you were about to talk about the ending of the film.
Well, I was going to talk about the ending for the same appeal, I guess, as what that sort of scenario provides for me. And it reminds me of working in a newsroom and all of the energy and the adrenaline around working. They're not even in a newsroom, but with people and in groups, you know, where that dynamic is present. But the ending with the typewriter.
Yes.
Just tapping out, you know, the last few lines, the ticker tape, reminiscent of the ticker tape. There's just so much of that typewriter that got me, that hooked me. I'd never realized it before. I was kind of watching it the other night. It was late at night, as I said, had my headphones on. It was really intimate. And then, you know, the ending happened. It went to black. I just went, that was awesome. That was so awesome. I got to go and write something, you know. And it's just, I don't know, all of the little sort of ritual, all of the paraphernalia, there was just so much there that, you know, for journalists particularly, just goes, all right, let's get to work, you know.
Let's get back to work.
The movie doesn't end there for journalists. It's like, all right, let's get into it.
Yeah.
And I guess... so many people are into it for that reason. Sorry, go on.
No, I was going to say there's a great quote from the great Roger Ebert, one of the greatest film critics who ever lived. And his great quote is like, when a movie ends, my work's only just beginning. And I just love that phrase of like, that's the same charge that journalists feel at the end of this movie, but I think it's the same charge that great film critics feel when they see any movie that moves them. And sometimes it moves you in a bad way, but I think even more so when a movie makes you sore and it like charges you with something. It's like, oh my God, I can't wait to get to work. I can't wait to get to work. I've got to go and wrangle with how this thing made me feel. But I think that this movie all the time, that's why I, you know, some people ask me where I get the energy to do the show. I'm like, just, have you seen the movie? Have you seen the movie?
Well, what other, that left me thinking, what other movies of this, you know, what would you call it? Like newspaper movies, journalist movies, political thrillers, whatever it might be. What other ones got me that I could recall? And I couldn't really come up with one in particular. Like even, what was the one about set in Boston there?
Oh, Spotlight. Spotlight is a contemporary one, yeah. I've heard the ones that I've heard the list is... And they do different things. Like Spotlight is the more, I don't know, it's like a bit of an interior movie because it's like this stuff's all happening and this has been news. And I think actually Spotlight has actually probably grown a little bit in people's conceptions recently because it's like there are things that systemically are wrong that are present in all culture. And I think sometimes when you take it to a microcosm of a town, like you can go, there are things systemically wrong with my town. And we should have had that responsibility. So it carries that weight and that guilt of we didn't do anything. Maybe not we as individuals, but we collectively should have kept this in check. And how did we let this happen? And I think that's a great quandary for journalism movies. The other one that people talk about, which is probably for emerging journalists, is Shattered Glass, which is it's a Hayden Christensen movie about the journalist who makes up his stories and then his editor sort of ends up holding him to account. So it's like a cautionary tale about like the worst thing that can happen. Again, not a very glamorizing journalist story at all. And then from filmmaker Michael Mann, which a lot of folks mentioned on this show, The Insider, which is about like corporate entanglement with journalism, very prescient to today, like telling great stories and then it being strangled by fear of reprisal, almost like, you know, reprisal from some company suing you for the wrongs, for the story getting out. And then you do have to go back. Like you got it like in the same year as Presidents is Network, you know, the How Bill Mad as Hell, like that is a journalism story 101. And it felt like a fantasy and a fallacy. Now you watch it and you're like, that's scarily accurate. it's really scary. As a genre and journalism stuff, like it doesn't pop up. The only other one, the big one that gets mentioned on this show, I think is The Wire, like that fifth season of The Wire, which shows the real trajectory of journalists in the newsroom, right on the cusp of like paper versus digital versus morality. And the guy who plays the dodgy journalist in that fifth season of The Wire, Tom McCarthy, is the director of Spotlight. The circle is complete.
Well, the other one, another TV show that it got me, at least. I don't know how widely it's recognized as doing the same sort of thing and charging journalists to get into their work, is an Australian series called Frontline.
Oh,
which hilarious. Is absolutely taking the mickey out of bad decisions, but there's just so much that I walk away with from those episodes, and that's something that I bought on DVD so I can watch it repeatedly.
If you are in America or UK, go and dial up Frontline. It stars Rob Sitch. It's produced by their team at Working Dog, and the Frontline is such a powerful show in Australia that the weird fuckery that occasionally happens on like mainstream current affairs shows, Frontline was so good that it made people forget what current affairs actually did that wasn't on Frontline, and then also predicted really weird things that a current affairs shows did. And you're like, wait, was that an episode of Frontline? Yes, it was. What, like, I can't believe this is actually happening on television. But I totally agree. It is a seminal show for me. A great show. I can't distinguish what actually happened in 80s/early 90s current affairs broadcasting in this country because I always think of Frontline.
And you still see it flash up. Certain stories and the same sorts of cock-ups or...
Yes.
The same sorts of unethical approaches to telling the story or sourcing the talent, you know, it's still there. And as you say, that was back in 93, 92, something like that.
Yeah, definitely. Early 90s. Those guys came out, came all up together at that time. Late 80s was the D generation. Yeah, not on ABC, 94. 94 was the first year. Yeah, yeah. May 94. God.
Well, I remember watching it around the it was the year I went into university to start this whole this whole trajectory. So yeah, it obviously made an impression on me back then, and you know, it's still something I return to as a touchstone. But look, getting back to this minute, what got me about the minute is the resilience of the two. You know, that for those people that just need a clarification on the minute, they've identified a political finance committee. And correct me if I'm wrong, right?
Yeah, no.
They've gone through. They're trying to narrow. They're trying to get someone on record to give them some details around.
Because the overall team is the committee to re-elect the president, and they've isolated just the people that are involved in finance. Because you know, from Deep Throat saying follow the money, it's like if we just get someone to get on the record for us in this finance thing, or at least put us on the right track, we'll go further. They've gone to this. I have to just quickly see who my guest was. I think it was in the previous episode to you, James Oliphant. So I can spoil it. He called her a Janet, you know, a prototypical Janet. They go to someone's house who is actually kind of this conspiratorial white woman who feels like she's the source in the story, but really she's just a consumer of the story. And she
welcomes them in.
She's complete red. Glad you're here. She's a complete red herring, right? It's the worst. But that seems like the straw that broke the camel's back. But yes, the committee to re-elect the president is the sort of the umbrella organization that Nixon has been orchestrating all this nastiness out of, and they're trying to narrow down the finance. And they are literally, they've gone to everyone on this list now at ad nauseum, and they've gone after the people in finance, and they simply cannot get anyone even close to, you know, not slamming the door in their face, except for a red herring who we see the culmination of in the beginning of this
movie. And it's really taken the wind out of Dustin Hoffman and Bernstein.
Yes.
He was the buoyant one. He was the optimistic one in right up to this point, and he's just slumped in the McDonald's booth. And he says something like, we can't go on. How do you keep going on when you know you don't have it and we're never going to get it? And that's probably the pivotal point where the Rob Redford, Woodward, is that the Woodward? He actually takes the front running and says, you know, we're going to get this, we're going to get it.
We just got to start
start again, go back the resilience, go through over the names all over again. And I think that for me, you know, inspirational moment, significant moment 100%. On every story, you know, that we work on. When you don't have it, when elements of stories that you just need a missing ingredient to, and what do? You just spike them or, you know, go in and have another crack. And I think, yeah, that's that minute. That's what I got out of it.
I think you're so right. And I love what you said there around there's a moment where you, especially the impulse that there's something there. Because I think that that's, Jack, when you said like that's, there's a missing ingredient, the missing implies to me like, you know this, you know, it's like, it would be like making a meal or a cake or something, and you're like, something's wrong. Like there's just something. So like I've all the ingredients are here. Or there's just one ingredient that's not here and I don't know what's going on. And it's just that it's not doing what it should do. And I think that like you said, that meticulousness, and it must feel like a punish, and the wind is out of you. And you're right. The slump, everything about it. Late night in a Macca's in Washington, just the decor, the yellow, like they feel like teeth that need to be brushed. These two guys in this room, right? There's the whole color palette of the room looks like I'm tired. I'm sallow. I'm just knackered. I don't want to be here. I've been in a car all day. It's Washington summer. It's hot. You know, from folk I've spoken to who live in Washington or have worked in Washington, it's like, it gets hot. So it's hot, sticky. I'm in a car all day. I'm outside. I'm taking the corduroy off. I'm getting it back on. But just that, but that for me is that that exercise of, I know there's something missing and I got to run, we have to run it back. We have to run it back. Because if we don't run it back, I'm going to regret it. I've got to go again.
There's another element that's important. It's the first time they're openly discussing this case.
Yes.
Without, you know, fear of people. You know, I think at this point they're worried about being followed. They're at least cognizant of the fact that people aren't happy with them following this line, that whether it's their news editors or whether it's the pressure that the news editors are getting from the White House. But here they are in a McDonald's restaurant, openly discussing the case. There's people in the booths next to them, and they kind of, you get the impression, it's not said, but you get the impression that they know that the general American populace doesn't give a rat's.
Yes.
They're not interested in the story, and they can be open in that sort of scenario.
And it becomes like some of the greatest moments of the film are them strategizing. So here it's like them getting themselves back together and having that candor to talk. And that fear certainly comes in later in the film. But it's like this leads to the next great conversation, which is after the incredible bookkeeper scene, which is what we're talking about, which is them strategizing how to get more information out of the bookkeeper. Well, if you say this, okay, cool. So what I'm going to do is you're going to say this and then I'm going to say, okay, cool. And it's really where you start to see how these guys complement each other, because it's like in that moment you needed Woodward's stubbornness and just like fortitude, like this is going to happen. And Hoffman had been buoyant more tenaciously that we're going to get this story some way, somehow before that. But yeah, you're so right. You don't need to say anything and this is the mastery of this whole movie. You don't need to say that these guys feel like no one cares, because talking about it openly says everything. And then them back in the car, and this is a great, it's part of this beautiful, just purely artistic tracking shot to music of their car getting back out on the road, the music soaring, the David Shire score, which just pops up. And it comes in really tactical moments in the movie. It's kind of nowhere in the movie, and then it's right upon you and you're swarming in it. And it comes into this big tracking shot, which essentially is, you know, it's led by this moment, but then it's hammered home, which is this whole city is still moving. It's still breathing. People are still commuting. The lights are still on. The president's still working. And these little guys in this one little tiny car are just going to get dwarfed by this entire city, by this entire story, by this entire country. It's like you are, if you weren't already ants, if you weren't already pushing shit uphill, like this is that moment that you're like, you really are desperate for the break. You are desperate for the break coming up.
Yeah, well, it's the other aspect is, early on, the editors actually say to them, don't they? Like, no one's going to be interested in this.
No one cares.
It's got nothing. It's a break-in. Like, so what? And it's just as the sequentially, each new layer or element of evidence or detail of story comes in, that it begins to snowball for them. And they're working as just machine parts in it until the end, when the actual machine part hammers out, you know.
Until the machine hammers out something, something bigger than the movie.
Yeah, which we're still seeing right now over in the States in terms of, you know, some of the behavior between the Nixon-esque type period and what we see with Trump around particularly civil rights with the BLM movement. Most notably, getting the streets outside the White House cleared with pepper spray and non-lethal projectiles, or whatever they, you know, that ordinance is called, so you can get a photo shoot in front of the church that he never attended the whole time he's been president.
And that the preacher then went on to national media going, he's never been there. He didn't ask for permission. He held the Bible upside down and he shot some of my parishioners, to move away. Like, there are some of the people who attend my church that got shot away with ordnance to get away from the church just so we could have a photo opportunity.
But in terms of a defining scene, defining visuals, that shot of him, side sort of profile shot of him in his ungainly gait, walking along the sidewalk, behind him, the streets being cleared. You've got the cops with the shotguns and whatever else, the shields and riot gear that they're clad up in. You got Trump being trailed by the heads of state and you know, whoever else was there, all white, you know, and just his ungainly gait as he's traipsing towards the church. I mean, to me, that was as evocative as the Richard Nixon V for Victory shaking hands at the top of the staircase as he's getting on the plane, you know. Like weeks or days before he resigned in disgrace.
I think the one thing we can be thankful of with Richard Nixon in hindsight is that the man felt shame.
Yeah.
That feels the major inversions. There's a couple of things I say just to make you amused. Imagine Richard Nixon with Twitter. It's always a fun game. It's always a fun game. Whenever you hear about him, imagining him with a man who kept a list of his enemies, imagine him with Twitter. You know, you can't say he's better than Trump necessarily because he didn't have Twitter. So we can't ever, it's only just a fun thought bubble game you can play.
Back to the film, that moment in the scene in the film where he puts the call in to, was it the senator or somebody he spoke to, and he got him late at night, or at least this guy was already asleep and he had a few to drink and he gave up more than he, it was essentially a drunken tweet, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. She's going to get a titty caught in a big ringer. It's those things you imagine, you go, oh my God. And you know, what I've loved about watching and following you guys on NRTV and watching what you're doing is that, you know, in America right now, some of the great truths to power, and there is a tipping point. There is starting to be an erosion with the collective weight of things like Black Lives Matter, with things like obviously the handling of COVID-19 and the pandemic in the States it's like scorched earth, you know, I mean, I don't know about you. I'd say to a few folk, like around this time this year, you know, so we're in July as we're recording this and you guys are going to hear it in July. I was planning on going to the States. I was planning on going at the end of summer, hanging out with some friends, seeing people, staying there, you know, maybe recording a few face-to-face podcasts with some great folk and going to see some movies at the New Beverly in LA and, you know, watch some stuff and be lucky enough to just travel and think about doing that. And I can't even, like, I'm like, it's definitely not this year, but maybe it's not even next year that you can go back, you know? And, you know, with Trump in power and just, you know, refusing to engage with people on something like Black Lives Matter. And then 3 weeks later, he's like advertising beans on the White House's desk because someone says something nice about him in the media. It's just like, what, what is this man? What is this office come to in the country's in the world's most influential country? It's pretty incredible.
It's surreal. There's an element of surrealism around it.
Yes.
I think, just to touch on what you were saying then, despite COVID and the travel restrictions that are, you know, being in place around the globe, I had the opportunity to go to the States just prior to, around the time that Trump got in, actually.
Yes.
And then again, a few, say 6 months later, the same opportunity, you know, rehashed, and it was an opportunity to go there. And it was to spend time with the founders of the BLM movement and travel between cities and between organizers to get an understanding and workshop and just familiarize myself with the BLM movement over there, the people, the prominent sort of figures in that movement. And there were various sort of iterations of how this would occur, whether it be a group of young Indigenous or, you know, Australian people of colour that went over there and we did it as a group, through to me just going over there by myself and hanging out with Patrice and Rodney and those sorts of people who I'd met when they come over to Australia to collect the Sydney Peace Prize, I think it was. We'd spent some time hanging out. So, yeah, it was all fairly familiar. There was a lot of incentive to go over.
Yes.
And I didn't because of Trump. There's not much that I could do, or more generally, the Australian people who oppose the sorts of things that Trump embodies could do to protest, his presidency. And it just felt to me that boycotting him, the travel to the US, was just one of those things, not putting my travel dollars over there or whatever it might be. So that's the reason why I haven't, and I still haven't been to the States either, but that's the reason why I didn't go across. Now with COVID, I'm not going to get there, but also, it would have been the BLM movement, the uprisings in the last 2 or 3 months now. They would have been great, but to be a part of, to observe, to be near the people that had fought, and organised since 2012, probably before that, but certainly since Trayvon Martin was murdered. It would have been, such a incredible experience to be, in that environment at that particular time. And that's the sorts of things that Trump prevents in the world, just by him holding that office.
Yeah, and but also
still such a hindrance.
But also to the time the times that you're going over there, Jack, is like, that puts you there for Charlottesville. You know what I'm saying? Like if you go over there at that time, talk about upheaval. Like, I mean, COVID is like a magnifying glass. It's an exacerbation. It just like ups the dose of whatever's happening. So like the surge of protests and uprising is because the concentrated thing, there's like 20% unemployment in America and people are, people are angered and they can't, there's no jobs to distract them. There's none of these minor distractions that we can get away with that are like, oh, it'll help diffuse how I'm feeling. It's like, it's in your face every single day. The whole place is shut down. I feel compelled to do these things. And I look at something like that. And when you say that, I can completely empathize and agree. And also, especially if you're going to hang out in the middle of the Black Lives Movement, like the Charlottesville stuff happens. It's just like it happened within the first year of his presidency. It's like, oh yeah, they're good people on both, bad people on both sides. And you're like, what are you talking about? There are modern Nazis marching through the streets.
Well, the other thing that we see here is the rise of fascism and Nazism in Australia, particularly in the southeast of Australia.
Yes.
I'm not sure about elsewhere, but particularly in Victoria and particularly in Melbourne and certain suburbs in Melbourne, to nail it even, be more specific. Around the BLM uprisings and the Aboriginal Lives Matter movement here, I mean, that provided personally for me, not being able to observe what was happening over in the States, but also as an organisation, a news organisation, NITV, provided an interesting parallel, I suppose, contrast point to what was happening in the US and the sorts of things Trump was saying. We had our PM say that, go on 2GB with Ray Hadley, to say that we shouldn't be importing the sorts of issues that were behind the BLM uprisings over there, which, like a lot of Aboriginal people, my jaw just dropped open and you sort of the hand come up to the forehead. Having those same issues?
That's the Patrick Stewart facepalm gif is the whole of 2020. But it's like, why are we importing it? And it's like, what are you talking about? No one's addressing it. Like, no one's even remotely addressing it. And this is the other frustration is, for however we as people felt about Scott Morrison getting the office, being in the office, being morally opposed to his views of the world, essentially. We're very fortunate that as a country, the leader decided that when we were discussing how we should resolve our response to COVID-19, they deferred their guidance to people who are trained to do that. And basically we just towed the line of our chief medical officer in the country, or my medical officers in the country and around the different states around how we should deal with these things. And I just think isn't that a novel approach? I mean, it sounds so stupid maybe to you and I, like stupidly obvious, but like, if you are talking about race relations and you want some clarity, is there not someone, you know, Dave Chappelle jokes, like you got to take your Mac mittens. You know, he talks about his mate, like someone from the streets coming in when he meets Hollywood people. Like, don't you have someone there if you're like talking about Indigenous affairs that is in your cabinet that actually has a line into someone who's an expert? Like, before I say this dumb thing, I should at least road test it with a mate who maybe can help articulate what is, or a confidant to say, well, this is what I would say. I wouldn't say that. I would say, look, it's a complicated, maybe just even saying it's a complicated issue and we don't have the same situation as the United States, but we do absolutely have ways to go. We can progress further. We can be better. Like, there's inspirational things that you can take from it, even if he's not morally obligated to be backing it or doesn't necessarily agree on certain levels. It's like, just take the more diplomatic road, be the bigger leader and say, we are not perfect. We have a ways to go. You know, there's a great clip. I actually might introduce our entire episode to it, of Justin Trudeau being asked about Donald Trump's response to Black Lives Matter at a press conference. He's the Prime Minister of Canada, for folks who don't know. And he took somewhere like 20 seconds of deliberating, not talking, just going and thinking. And it was so refreshing. Oh, someone needed to think before they said something. That's nice. That's really nice.
Well, I heard a lot of criticism around that at the time, that it was very performative and all of that sort of thing.
Yes.
Yeah, it was.
It was.
It was exactly what was needed.
Yes. Yeah, he might have put some shine on it, but also it's like, have some thought. And if people interrogate us, like, look, I was genuinely thinking about what the best response was.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, it surprises me that you say the cabinet or the advisors of the PM, you know, should be in his ear saying, maybe, you know, if you do get this question, there's a few talking points that you want to bring up. What surprises me is that for the past, certainly leading up to May 18 last year, the election, so many of these politicians, the PM included, went on listening to us, to Aboriginal communities or Aboriginal regions or Aboriginal leaders or families, you know, and you'd hear it in the media coverage all the time, you know, whether it was Turnbull going up to Tennant Creek or the PM, you know, going somewhere else. Abbott was getting around as a special envoy to Aboriginal people. God.
Batuta advocate of skewered Uncle Tony Abbott, as they called him for months. And it's been one of my great internet joys. I think if you just type in Batuta advocate, B-E-T-O-O-T-A advocate, it's essentially Australia's answer to The Onion. And Tony Abbott, who is deeply conservative, arguably, or probably inarguably, racist, misogynistic, former prime minister of this country, and just an all-round idiot, being appointed with an Indigenous affairs moniker prior to his eventual demise from politics. It was just one of the most laughable appointments almost of all time in Australian politics.
No. More laughable is him recently getting an Order of Australia medal for that role.
Well, he did give Prince Philip the Order of Australia or some nonsense.
He brought the whole concept back 2 or 3 years, whatever period of time it's been. He gets the actual award for something as idiotic as what giving one of Prince Philip was in the first place. I mean, Bruce McAvaney, a small comedy here, we call it synchronicity, delicious synchronicity.
This is the first mention of Bruce McAvaney on this show, and I'm all about it. I'm all about it.
Bruce has got a lot to offer.
But I think you're so right, and this is part of the, you know, part of what I've relished about the show is just having the dialogue that, you know, in our country, in Australia, there's so much deflection and it's very easy to do. There's a lot of deflection to be able to say, oh, United States is like this. And I want to talk to everyone who's listening to the show. I don't want to be that person who is ever
in any way looking down on people's, you know, looking down on people's other countries or how other countries have acted or who they've elected with any kind of superiority complex, because Australia has our own stack of idiots that have ran this country, and or people who you may have been morally opposed to that have done great things in politics. You know, John Howard, who is one of our longest serving prime ministers of all time, is arguably has a lot of questionable stuff on international politics, has done some really heinous things for refugees, but the guy got guns out of this country. So I don't have to worry when I walk my kids down a street in Sydney that they're going to get shot, or that if and when they go to school, which is a couple of years away for my oldest, that's a concern for them. So, I mean, I think in Australia's current political climate, I just always, Jack, think about this is in opportunities like this, where there's this surging time for change, there's just ways that even if you don't agree that you can be diplomatic. And I just feel like I've worked in corporations, you've worked in corporate places and stuff. It's like, there are so many fixers and people that like advisors and stuff that are around you, like even in a corporate sense, they would just never let you say something so stupid and inflammatory. So then you see when the prime minister does it and you're like, how does that happen? Mm-hmm. Trump is a different entity altogether, because this is a man who, like, you know, they can take his life, but they'll never take his Twitter, you know, like he's just like, he's the guy who will tweet until the bitter end. But yeah, I don't want to seem like we're above it, because there's just so much, there's so many ways you can tackle like that discontent, and you don't have to cause more, you know, more fissures, more excuses for us not to be a community, especially at this time.
No, look, that brings us full circle back to the top of what we were talking about at the start of the episode, the political economy of news media in this country. So concentrated that people's awareness on these sorts of similarities, parallels, is pretty much zero, collectively at least. We have media like, you know, the NITVs, the Indigenous X's, the Courier Mail, you know, black-led media, niche media in other areas or issues, but just not reaching enough people. But more importantly, NITV being the national Indigenous television station, a public broadcaster, predominantly black, you know, up until it's black editorial now, but predominantly in the past, black, you know, led editorial, journalistic practice, just not being picked up by any of the white news media organizations in the way that they tackle or, you know, approach, cover Indigenous stories, Indigenous issues. So why isn't that the case, that they wouldn't look across occasionally at NITV or the work online from NITV news online and just go, oh, is that how you do it? Is that like, oh, all right.
It just seems,
don't get that.
It seems baffling to me, just in general, like you see great teams of, you know, great editorial teams and great writing teams, and you see internationally, just even in culture journalism, just watching the emergence of some of the most incredible black voices. You know, there's a, you know, for fans of these podcasts, Angelica Jade Bastien, who writes for New York Magazine and Vulture, may be the best film critic that's worked today. And in 10 years time, they might talk about her like a Pauline Kael or something like that. Like, she's that good. Emerging writers from Chicago, who I'm lucky enough to have had on the show, like Robert Daniels and stuff like that. Like, it just feels like in your arsenal of a great editorial team, you've got to have those great voices. You know, I've got another friend, American Iranian film critic, Roxana Haddadi, has been on the show a couple of times. It's like, you've got to have those voices to talk about issues and to pitch issues that are for their perspective, because it's different. It's just different to yours. And I totally agree. It's like in Australia, it's so lazy. The magazine 24-hour news cycle television that happens on the media, because, like, you know, which I'm thankful for, and I've actually said it on this show, I'm thankful for things like people getting sued for having a panel of three white people propose a new Stolen Generation on like Channel 7 in the morning. Like, that, they should be sued. That company should be held to account. Like, surely one of 100 great Indigenous journalists that could have been on a panel to discuss something that is involving Indigenous affairs in this country.
This is the thing. And for international listeners, there is a great silence. It's called Great Silence in Australia. It's a deliberate sort of omission of past histories and decisions and policies and things like that. Now, Channel 7, the morning show or Today Show, whatever it's called, the morning program, they basically just ran exactly that line for a long period. Like, their decision around having those three particular non-Indigenous and, you know, inflammatory type profile people discussing something so sensitive as forced child removal by the state from Aboriginal parents, that decision wasn't made in a vacuum or wasn't an isolated incident. They have long period of form omitting and erasing the sorts of things that, you know, people have arced up at. Then, more recently with the BLM stuff, but prior to that, they, you know, there's an Aboriginal journalist, commentator called Amy McGuire, who was working in Canberra in the Canberra Press Gallery at the time that they had a morning show being broadcast from, you know, the front yard of the Parliament House. And there was a rally, a bunch of communities had come down from Central Australia to rally about child removal on the forelawn. And that's Channel 7, Today Show, had set up their makeshift broadcast in front of it, and they actually held up a blanket to block out the protest behind them, right? And then jump forward again, probably two or three years, the Commonwealth Games on the Gold Coast, and I happened to be up there for the protests around that, covering it for the Guardian and Courier Mail, actually, and the same thing happened. They had a little makeshift sort of studio set up, backdrop of the beach. So I was up on the Gold Coast, paradise, you know, pretty
broad,
nice.
Nice broad beach background, looks like Miami.
Yeah, the towers, the glass and steel towers, oh, fantastic. But the stolen wealth protest march got wind of it. I think they got a tip off from somebody inside Channel 7 that it was going to be at that location at that time. So they've gone down there, and whether that was a deliberate tip off or not, who knows?
Yes.
But they went down there and they were rallying, you know, protesting, clamoring behind the setup, you know, the hosts and their couches and that sort of thing. And again, they attempted to hold a sheet up to block them out. Now, the idiocy behind it, they should have embraced it. It would have increased their ratings, the conflict on screen, all of that sort of thing. But, yeah, they went to try and to block it out, amid it with some sheeting. So that's the form that they carry in. Let's not forget also they had pretty much a running slot for Pauline Hanson.
Yes.
Who is, you know, has been a preeminent racist.
Australian politics
since 95 or something, six maybe.
A few episodes earlier, on episode 65, I invited a friend on the show again for his second appearance, Travis Johnson, a film critic, and I. And usually Travis is the angry one, but maybe it was just the week, but it was around the week that we recorded the whole Pauline Hanson thing. And a preeminent racist in this country, a political fringe dweller that has been basically satiated. Like, she's been a parasite of the political machine for about 20 years, has a very strong base in like three suburbs in Queensland. And that's about it. And one of the biggest national broadcasters basically gave her a permanent slot to be racist on national television to sort of stunt, car crash her into notoriety for many years, including putting her on Dancing with the Fucking Stars. And I got angry because they're like, they gave her a stunt slot, then apologized for it and banned her from being on their show. But they've got more analysis to do. They've got more apology to do, because it's 20 years of this person being in our media because of them. So you can apologize not just for that one event where she says something racist. You could apologize for almost every time she's been on your show saying things that are racist for a variety of minority people in this country. And it just seems so unfathomable to me, Jack, that like they're like, oh, I'm sorry now. Now, 20 years, mm-hmm. we'd never have heard. Like, it was 96 or 7 that she came to political notoriety, never got more than 5% of the vote, barely has been able to hold on to a senator seat, barely can string a sentence together. You give her a TV slot every day.
Yeah. No, that's right. Harris. And that sounds entirely reasonable. but also, as you say, she went to jail at one point for misappropriation of funds,
political funds.
And they got her back. They redeemed her pretty much with the debt.
Like a phoenix.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
So, look, it's extraordinary. And for those sorts of programs, the Channel 7, whatever it's called, breakfast show, Sunrise, that's what it's called. For Sunrise, and Channel 9's offering today, to turn around in the present sort of climate and, you know, pose and print as if they're mindful of the Aboriginal Lives Matter or Black Lives Matter movement and attempt to get in on it with whatever, you know, whatever sort of method or mode that they try to do it, whether it's having the token, and I say token because it is, Aboriginal guest or person of colour as a guest or a regular on the couch from this point going forward. Like, it's just, it's offensive. It's offensive, and it's part of a broader sort of thing internationally, but, you know, just more likely here in Australia, of the reconciliation, you know, movement. The onus always seems to be on Aboriginal people reconciling themselves to the fact that they're not going to get proper land rights. So, you know, it's a, you know, to be cynical about it, it's another organ to reiterate its sort of assimilation policies and practices. I mean, there'd be a lot of people that are part of Reconciliation Australia that might be upset with me saying that, but, you know, there can be so much more done for genuine reconciliation than what is happening in Australia. And a morning television program with a long form line of racist shit can't just, you know, wash itself, absolve itself with the appointment of an Aboriginal host or guest or all black panel for one session. Today's show has got an Aboriginal journalist named Brooke Boney, who joined them last year, maybe a little bit further back than that. And she's ostensibly an entertainment journalist and host to provide, you know, that sort of thing for the program. But whenever they need her to say something around the contested national date of January 26 / Australia Day / Invasion Day / Survival Day, they will, you know, all of a sudden she's not the entertainment journalist. She is a political commentator who gets a couple of minutes to, you know, camera time to say something that's going to provoke their readership into engaging below the line or in their social media comment threads. And a barrage, inevitably a barrage, a tsunami of racist sentiment washes in, and not having a go at the issue or the topic, but playing the person and really, you know, taking, it'll be difficult for Brooke. It's not a safe working environment, firstly, for her employer to be putting her in. Let's not forget that.
Yes.
But also just to bear that, the brunt of that and being set up to do it. Now, they probably learnt from the first time or second time that they did it, and they're not
probably the fifth time, fourth time.
But they still cut to her to provide explanation and context as though that is her job, because she's an Aboriginal person that they've employed. And without sort of, you know, that you don't see him cutting across to somebody else to provide the same sort of service who isn't Aboriginal, you know, to explain, I don't know, why people were buying so much toilet paper. Go across to Kochi. He's going to give us an explanation about white people and toilet paper. What are you doing that for? But we see that with Brooke, and you know, I'm offended on her behalf, and I'm concerned for her health.
Yes,
and it's not just me, but a lot of my colleagues within.
It's an invitation for her to get slammed.
Yeah, like
just women in general,
and persecute, social, yeah. Like, yeah. Not slam, like persecute her identity, yeah. Where they, you know, the sorts of things, and it's pretty gross, but you know, that woman's about as Aboriginal as my left testicle, and you know, comments like that. That's one that I read the other day. So yeah, that's really difficult because, you know, for international guests, even Australian guests who don't get it, listeners that don't get it, that is a difficult burden and traumatic for Aboriginal people, individuals, to wear, to cop, because there's a long history there of the state, you know, very strategically and fiercely and diligently attempting to erase our very existence by, you know, taking us of our kids, taking the kids away from the parents, depriving us of languages, but, you know, trying to essentially breed us out, smoothing the pillow as we die out, as it was phrased once. So when, you know, an Aboriginal person who has grown up in Aboriginal culturally, in a community, in identity, has a wave of people saying, you're not Aboriginal, like that's a really confronting thing. It's a really personally offensive thing,
yes,
to say that you're not what we made you. You know, you are not the thing that we hated, that we tried to take away from you, that we don't like. You're not that, but you kind of are, and that's why we're doing it. Like, it's a really weird.
It's unfair to make that person a singular target too, because that's the other thing, is when you are a token voice on such a massive program and there's not a dialogue, a genuine committed dialogue about something, it becomes just like you are, all you're doing is just laser focusing on all of the hate and infective and that real fringe, and you know, sometimes majority, but that fringe of people who are willing to go on there and like devalue you as an individual, as a person, devalue your culture, devalue your contribution. And it just feels like those shows could genuinely make a difference. They reach a lot of people.
Yeah. Like they're the most popular shows on free-to-air television.
They reach a lot of people. And if they actually had a genuine dialogue about, are we like, could we all just not, like, if you want another public holiday, we'll just make the national day like the 1st of Jan, and we'll just keep that as a public holiday on the 26th and call it something else.
Yeah. Call it
Reconciliation Day. We'll just keep
we won't have the military fanfare of the jets flying over and the,
We can have that on New Year's Day. We can have that on New Year's Day, because that's technically when Australia was created. We can have that on New Year's Day, and you can wave your flags, and a lot of the idiots who with the Southern Cross tattoos and who wear the flag, the Australian flag, all those guys can be hung over. So they probably might miss out on their flag waving duties on that day, but they can sort of back up, you know, hair at the dog and just go for it on New Year's Day as well. And Bob Strong.
Well, how Aussie are you? Are you going to get up with your hangover and wave your flag? How are the
mate? That's I want to copyright that, because I think we're close. I think if we can have any influence out of, there's a lot of things that can happen out of this podcast. If one of them is that the date is changed, that is I'm telling you, you can reach Jack and I via Twitter. That they're the best places to find. But there's your campaign right there. How Aussie are you to back up from New Year's Eve to get on it the next day? Oh my goodness. Mate, this has been such a fun and sprawling and enlightening conversation for me personally, and I hope that for the listeners. And it's been a real treat to talk to you. You're awesome. I admire what you do, and I think that I think it's really good and fascinating for people to hear from an Indigenous man such as yourself to talk about like the challenges, and to add some reality to that, and to actually contextualize in this country that we are not above or detached from these issues in our own country. We have our own context that is very relevant and continues to be relevant and continue to be challenging. And I just, yeah, it's been a real treat talking to you about this. And I'm so glad that this movie brought us together talking about this. I wish I could get some Maccas with you and say, how Aussie are you? To a few people who refuse to back up on Australia Day, but it's probably a long ways off. So it's been a real treat talking to you.
It might be some way off, but it will happen. No, look, thanks for having me on. It's been great. And any time in the future, I'll make myself available.
Wow, that was a great convo. God, I loved having the awesome Jack Lattimore, which you can find on Twitter at @LattimoreJack, LATIMORE. He's the digital editor at NITV News, but you can also find him on the Take It Black BLAK podcast, where he's the co-host there. So you can find all of his stuff there. Jump off on Twitter and go and subscribe to the Take It Black podcast, where you can hear him. As he offered, we will very, very gratefully oblige Jack another visit here. He was just so great. And so we're going to talk to him again. He's awesome. You guys are going to hear from him. You're awesome for listening to All the President's Minutes. Thank you so much for listening to the show. Guys, if you can, at the very least, please subscribe, rate, and review the show. The reviews help get it in front of more people. If you have a few extra bucks, there's a donation link in the description of this podcast. We appreciate you. We'll catch you on another episode very soon. Thanks for listening.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.